The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the Green Front. This is a remote edition of my program. Betsy Rosenberg here reporting from Laguna Niguel in beautiful Southern California from the Ritz-Carlton. And this is a fancy conference as far as green conferences go. This is the fourth annual Fortune Brainstorm Green Conference. It is put on by Fortune Magazine. And I have been coming to these for 3 out of the 4 years. Last year I monitored it on my computer. But when you do that, you get to see the sessions, but you miss all the interesting conversations, sometimes the more interesting conversations that take place out in the hallway. The conference is a 3-day conference. It began Wednesday, so it was Monday. It's a green blur. Wrapping up in just about a half hour here, the conference opened up with Richard Branson, of course, the aviator, the adventurer, the very green, very public leader. He's almost an activist, really, for certainly someone, you know, leading an industry. Richard Branson spoke about something that was released yesterday. We got a little bit of a scoop on how he's going to be exploring about 30,000 feet under instead of dealing with airplanes only that are 30,000 feet above the ground, talking about submarine and ocean exploration. So that was exciting to have him as a last-minute keynote speaker on Monday night. Had a full day of speakers yesterday. Some highlights included Van Jones, Tom Steyer, who's a big financier from San Francisco, talking about funding clean tech projects and other really green energy projects that are really key to the sustainability movement going forward. Of course, he, working in San Francisco, was very plugged into Silicon Valley and all the big high-tech firms down there. This conference is put on by Fortune. All their editors and writers are here. Hope to be having one join us in just a few minutes. David Whitford is an editor at large and also a Time Magazine environmental reporter. We're hoping to hear from Brian Walsh here in just a couple minutes. At the bottom of the hour, I hope to have joining me live Will Sarney. He is a consultant on sustainability issues. He's been working with lots of large companies like Alcoa, and he's recently working with Deloitte on water issues. He's a real expert on water. And so we have quite a range of people here. Really, just to set the tone, I call this sort of the Cadillac or maybe the Mercedes-Benz or even the Tesla of the Green Conferences because, you know, it is Fortune, you know, magazine, so you get CEOs and executives from all the big companies that are interested in going green. And again, I started coming here 4 years ago. Big companies like Starbucks, IBM are all here. And now there's Johnson, S.C. Johnson has been a big player in the sustainability movement. Fisk Johnson, the chairman and CEO of that family-run company, was speaking yesterday. And it's really interesting to see, frankly, a lot of men in suits here. There are women, too, but it's a more formal gathering, I would say, than some of the recycling conferences or the climate change conferences that I've attended over the years. But it also is more exciting because the caliber of the people in the room, just in terms of their power and their influence, since they are in the financial world, in the business world, and because of the high level of CEOs that you get here, talking about green issues, talking about energy problems, talking about climate change in a way that really conveys urgency and all the things you'd expect from an environmental gathering. But again, these are people who are pretty influential. We had Fred Krupp speaking the first day. Of course, he's the president of the Environmental Defense Fund, and also Michael Schellenberger, famously of the Death of Environmentalism paper. He's now the president and co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute. And Amy Christensen used to be with Google.org. She's the founder and CEO of Christensen Global Strategies. She works with a lot of companies on their sustainability policies. Also, the first day we heard from David Steiner. He is the president and CEO of Waste Management. I've been covering this beat long enough that I recall when they were a garbage company. Now they've really kind of recycled their image into one of garbage and recycling company and waste management in a more environmentally responsible way. So that's really, that image is something that they're working to strengthen because it makes them good stewards, and they're increasingly living up to that image, I'm happy to say. Also, the first day, yesterday actually, we had Majora Carter. She's with the Majora Carter Group. Of course, she does great work along with Van Jones on environmental justice issues. Van Jones, as I mentioned, was here. He is always a popular guest speaker. He was very, you know, bold, as he always is, and he talks about how we really need to engage the government to be a partner in these problems that we have as far as energy and environmental challenges. Van Jones, of course, famously was the green jobs czar under President Obama in the White House, but after 6 months, he left in a little controversy that Glenn Beck started. It got personal, and Van Jones took the high road and decided to step down, and he says even though people lament the fact that he was only there a short time, he says, well, I was in the White House for 6 months more than most people, so he's proud of that and had some interesting things to say. Right now, William McDonough, the father of green design, is speaking. He's always concerned with waste and about cradle-to-cradle life cycle of products, hoping he may join us for the last few minutes, but it's kind of hard to grab people because everyone is listening to the speakers while we're doing a program here. So I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, hopefully we'll have someone from Fortune and Time Magazine joining us, one or the other. This is Betsy Rosenberg. Stay tuned on the Green Front, reporting from the Fortune Green Business Conference in Laguna Niguel. Be right back.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
This is Barry Farber with the best self-improvement advice you've ever had or ever heard. Learn a foreign language. Sounds impossible? Give me a chance to prove it. I'm Barry Farber. I can guide you to mastery of any language in the world quickly, easily, inexpensively, and at home. You will grow culturally, linguistically, intellectually, commercially, professionally, even romantically. Get that smile off. Face it, happened to me. The Barry Farber Language Club, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Tuesdays, 3. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the expat files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Hello. This is Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host of Animal Magnet Pet Radio. You can listen live to me every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the best pet radio in America, Canada, and beyond. Hard-hitting pet issues, animal news, training tips, tricks, games, and quirky pet trivia, plus the A-list pet guests each week. Or listen anytime to past shows at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Listen to this show so you can be good to your animals.
The Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Welcome back to the Green Front. I am now joined by two journalists. We're going to have one at a time. First, David Whitford. He's an editor at large with Fortune Magazine, and then we'll be following him with Brian Walsh, who is a staff writer with Time Magazine, and there's a great cover story next week's Time. He'll be talking about that. But first, David, welcome to the Green Front. Thanks for stepping into the press room here.
Thanks, Betsy.
This is the fourth Fortune Green Conference. As I said, this is one of my favorites. Not only is the food better here at the Ritz-Carlton, a little bit nicer than the average recycling conference, but you really get high-caliber people from the corporate world, all of them businesses that are leaning in a green direction. This is a powerful group. It's a lot of, as I said, a lot of men in suits, but their hearts and their minds genuinely seem to be in the right place. Talking about Leslie Dax of Walmart, we have Starbucks here, a lot of the green electric car representatives. Tell us a little bit about the origin of this conference. I was so pleased and surprised 4 years ago when I saw that Fortune Magazine was having a gathering.
Yeah, you know, what I love about this conference is that we get not just corporate CEOs, but also a lot of good people from NGOs, environmental activists. I mean, it's a place where people who don't normally talk to each other get together and share ideas. So I think it's really valuable in that respect.
What made Fortune realize that this was a subject area worthy of its own conference? And does Fortune have other such gatherings?
Well, Fortune does other conferences. You know, we do there's a sort of brainstorm franchise, right? They do a brainstorm technology conference. We have a conference around our most powerful women in business issue that is has been going on for a long time. I think the idea with Brainstorm Green was that, you know, we had been writing about green issues for a while. And there was a sense, I think, that it had gone beyond the point where it was, you know, strictly about marketing. It had gone beyond the point where you had to persuade corporations to make investments in green. And it, you know, I think we felt that the business culture was beginning to recognize a real investment opportunity, an opportunity to save the world, an opportunity to forestall climate disaster, but also an opportunity to make money. And those aren't necessarily inconsistent. And so the feeling was, let's get everybody together. And, you know, it's a great thing for us as reporters, too, because it gives us several days to mingle and share ideas with people who are at the forefront in their various fields, and generates a lot of story ideas that we feed off of for the rest of the year.
And there are some of the same companies I've seen here over the last few years, Walmart, Starbucks, but seeing some new ones as well.
Right. You know, the focus changes a little bit from year to year. We had a breakfast panel this morning on water, for example. There was a guy there from Molson Coors talking about the steps that his company has taken to, you know, document water usage and involve its in the process of that documentation, get involved with various stakeholders, the people who live in the community that also rely on water, that the same water that they used for their brewing. And I think that water is becoming something that's increasingly at the front of people's minds when they think about green issues. It's an energy issue, as well as a food issue and a manufacturing issue. And I think it's an example of I think that's going to be a bigger topic next year. The conference evolves as concerns evolve.
Yeah, in fact, they say water will be the next oil, and in fact, Will Sarney will be joining us at the bottom of the hour to talk about water issues. That's one of his areas of expertise. This is pretty serious stuff that's discussed here, as environmental issues tend to be, climate change, peak oil, energy issues. But you also have lighter things like the gentleman from Patron Tequila yesterday talking about how their company recycles a lot of the agave waste. And so it's a really interesting mix and not something that one might expect necessarily, a range of not the usual suspects, I should say.
Now, you pick up all kinds of great stuff. I mean, I came here to this conference this year with a particular interest in what people had to say about nuclear power, for example.
In the wake of Japan.
In the wake of Japan, right. Nuclear power is something that, has become a green issue. I think most people who care about the environment sort of recognize that if we're going to get anywhere near the sort of carbon goals that we've set for ourselves as a society, that we can't eliminate nuclear power from the equation. So I was interested to hear, how people's thinking about that may have changed in wake of Japan. Mm-hmm. You just pick up great tidbits. I love, I forget who it was yesterday who introduced the concept of talking about different ways in which you can generate power and the consequences of each. And introduce the concept of deaths per kilowatt hour. I don't know if you were there for that.
No,
I missed
that one.
It's a great idea. It's a way of truly examining the consequences of all forms of energy production. Coal would not fare very well under that equation.
Yeah, you had one of the panels was is coal still king, and there was a lot of discussion, mostly friendly, although Alan Saltzman was shaking his head no a lot as the coal representative was making some claims. And then at the very end, they asked the question again, the moderator, is coal king? And of course, the coal representative said, well, if not king, we're still alive. don't count us out yet.
Yeah, and he made an interesting point about, carbon sequestration, this process by which you capture the carbon that's generated by burning coal and store it underground or sell it back to industry for industrial purposes.
That's when Alan Saltzman was shaking his head no on sequestration.
Yeah.
And clean coal. That's a
right.
Controversial topic.
Well, clean coal may be an oxymoron. I don't know. The Atlantic did a big cover story in December suggesting that if we're going to meet these carbon goals that we can't. We need to think about coal and carbon sequestration in coal because a lot of countries around the world are continuing to build coal power plants. And if we accept that as a given, then we need to think seriously about sequestration. As the guy from American Power said, what did he say? Capture works, storage works, but it's not inexpensive.
When Fortune held the first Brainstorm Green conference 4 years ago, was there a sense that this would be an annual event, or was it thought to be a one-time event and it turned out to be so successful that you are continuing it going forward?
I'm sure the hope was that it would become an annual event, and we're certain now that it will. It's gotten stronger year by year. And, as we were talking before, the agenda changes a little bit from year to year. But these are big issues, important issues that engage a lot of really interesting people. And I'm looking forward to coming back to this for years to come.
I agree. It is it does a lot of things, but most of all, it legitimizes the fact that this is about money, and that unfortunately is the litmus test for what's important in America, not only in terms of what can be saved at the bottom line, but also money that can be made. And whoever comes up with the cleanest technology, and we're behind China right now, is going to that's the message that I hear so many places, but in this particular circle, it has resonance. Because we don't like to be, we're competitive. We don't like to be falling behind. And this is one area where, for some reason, it's been politicized, and it's okay. But, you know, the U.S. is not really getting on the clean tech bandwagon fast enough compared to China.
Now, China's an interesting case. You know, there was a workshop today in the main ballroom on China, people talking about investments in clean energy in China, and it was significant to me sitting there listening to the Chinese talking about how they hope to become a model that the rest of the world can follow in clean tech and energy technology, clean energy generation. How critical it is that, you know, what they do becomes a standard for the rest of the world. And it was an interesting moment. The torch of economic leadership is passing. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, and it's already beginning to happen. The whole world is deeply interested in what's happening in China. Burgeoning population, growing economy, and an incredible amount of power generation happening there. And we really need China to move beyond coal and embrace cleaner technologies. And if it can't move beyond coal, we need them to do coal in the best possible way. It's absolutely vital to the survival of the planet.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for being with us. Any final thoughts before we switch over to Brian Walsh of Time?
No, I'm sure Brian's got lots more things to say than I do, but it's been a great conference, and I would encourage people to either think about joining us here next year, or you can also participate online. A lot of the events have been have gone up live online, and there's it's an opportunity not just to listen and to hear, but also to participate through Twitter and that sort of thing.
And will there be more coverage on this in the next edition, next issue?
Yeah, we'll do something. I'm almost certain. Yeah, we'll do something in our next issue that'll summarize this stuff, and we'll be, a lot of coverage, continuing coverage at Fortune.com.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your great work. Thank you, Fortune Magazine, for including and welcoming the press. That's nice to see.
Yeah.
Since you're media, that makes sense.
Thank you, Betsy.
Okay, see you next year. Bye-bye. And I'm going to be speaking with Brian Walsh in just a moment. You've probably seen his byline if you're at all interested in environmental issues. I read all of his pieces in Time magazine. He's really been covering this issue predominantly. And there's, in fact, a special on the April 11th edition called This Rock Could Power the World, Why Shale Can Solve the Energy Crisis, but not without some controversy, because some people say drilling for it threatens our land, is not safe. But there's apparently about a century worth of it buried in our own backyards, according to the cover. Thank you for joining us on the Green Front. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You've led some interesting panels, and you've been covering this issue for Time. What strikes you about this gathering this year? It's the fourth annual. It seems to be growing strong, and the conversations are, you know, getting more and more interesting as our challenges grow more urgent and more complex, but just as many solutions and alternatives, you know, being showcased.
I mean, to me, the fact this has continued now for 4 years shows that there's a sustainability to sustainability, in a sense, in the business.
Well put.
It's not something that just coming out of 2006, 2007, when this issue was very hot. You're seeing companies continue to work in this field, seeing opportunities, seeing things they can change about themselves, and that'll go on. Even if it's not necessarily always the highest topic in the media, what was repeated again and again was this idea that, you know, they may be doing it in part to look good. Obviously, they're concerned about that. But the reality is that the only sustainable business practices are ones that also make money for them, which, as the previous guest was showing. So I think it's something that you'll see, you know, going forward. And it's also, you know, climate change was such a big topic in recent years. To me, what's being talked about much more now is a sort of sense of resource scarcity, whether that's energy, whether that's water, whether that's food, which is becoming bigger and bigger. That's what's really framing the discussion right now. Climate change, of course, being a part of that kind of as a multiplier of those effects. But really, it's the idea of how do we keep growing in a situation where we have a limited planet.
And are you new to be covering environmental issues almost exclusively for Time? Just the fact that they have someone on this beat, I think, speaks volumes.
Right. Well, I've been doing it for 3.5 years now with Time here. It's interesting, you know, if you look back at the history of the magazine, we've sort of had periods of times when we had someone just focusing on environmental issues and we didn't. It sort of mimics how this issue is going up and down in the media and the public interest. But I think, again, if you look at what I do now, it's less green, perhaps, than it was in the past. Now, it's not just about the sort of traditional issues of environmentalism, like pollution, like endangered species, although I do write about that. It's much more about energy and the global race for energy, and the global race to come up with new forms of energy, whether that's something like natural gas and shale gas, which is sort of a variation of the forms of energy we're already using, or whether you're talking to people that you'll meet in a conference like this who are coming up with new ways for cellulosic biofuel, new ways for solar power, things like that. It's both. It's happening simultaneously.
Are you seeing as much innovation in terms of clean technology and just sustainability practices that's encouraging you, or do you think we've kind of hit a plateau in terms of what we are seeing from corporations?
When I see from major corporations, I see a lot of innovation in terms of improving efficiency. You can talk to almost any company here and really elsewhere, and they're very focused on trying to improve that bottom line, understanding that they no longer live in a world where inputs are infinite, in a sense. They have to husband those resources if they want to continue to grow. So that's happening, and that will happen regardless of what goes on politically in Washington, regardless of what goes on internationally. Companies know that, and they're competing to be the leaders in those areas. In terms of clean energy innovation, that's an area that kind of comes and goes, I think. You saw a burst of financing, venture financing in past years. That's kind of leveled off somewhat, in part, I think, because of concerns about policy, not knowing how much support there will be going forward, especially it's very uncertain right now. And that's problematic. I mean, while there's a lot of great ideas out there, and there are people who want to fund those, at the same time, the reality is a lot of these newer energy sources are not going to be competitive unless they have some form of aid, some form of subsidy. And with that in doubt, at least in the United States, that's very problematic. On the other hand, of course, you're seeing a lot of innovation going on in other countries as well. It would be a mistake just to look at that through the U.S. pyramid prism. We just had, of course, a China panel just on the stage at the Fortune Green Brainstorm Conference, and there you see a lot of energy coming from the government as well. You see basic funding, and you see a willingness to really put forward new solutions and to see them through, not just about climate change, but also about just dealing with their very serious pollution problem.
Right, and you have a article that I can't wait to read, This Rock Could Power the World. Looks like any basic rock. What's the secret there?
Well, this is that's the shale rock, actually. It's from the Marcellus Shale, which is a geologic layer that goes from about West Virginia up through Pennsylvania into New York State, about 7,000 feet below the ground. And it contains lots of natural gas. And geologists have known that for a while, but it's only recently that the industry has actually been able to figure out a way to economically get at that gas. And once they did, it's called hydraulic fracturing, which has a lot of environmental issues that are sort of mentioned in that piece. And, of course, this is the problem with energy source. There are going to be the threats and risks that go along with the benefit. But in this case, basically, the ability to tap this resource has just exploded the amount of natural gas the U.S. and actually other countries, because other countries also have similar deposits like this, has at its disposal. So now you have a situation where you have an energy source that is, on a relative sense, a lot cleaner than coal. And you were talking with the previous guest about coal, and the simple reality is coal is incredibly deadly, polluting, also bad for the climate. Gas is better. It can be kind of a bridge fuel to a more renewable energy source as the forms of energy begin to scale up. So it's there, and it does have the power to really change the economics of how we get electricity.
And speaking of deadly, we've just seen an incredible year, tragic year, of worst-case scenarios. It was just a year ago that the coal mine explosion happened, killing some 24 miners in West Virginia. That was overshadowed by the BP oil spill, what I call the kill, that, you know, was on top of the news every night for months. Obviously a tragedy, worst case scenario. And then we had Japan with the 9.0 monster quake, followed by the tsunami and the nuclear partial meltdown, which is still, not resolved. So this should really refocus our national conversation and attention, I would think, on our energy needs, which are growing, our consumption, which is growing, and how we cannot count on, lack of human error or not necessarily, worst case scenarios happen, and we just saw that. And do you think that will, in fact, serve as a perfect storm to refocus the conversation in Washington, in corporate boardrooms, in media, and the public?
I would sure hope so, although, just the history of Americans on energy policy is not good on that.
Short attention spans.
Very much so. President Obama, in his energy speech just last week, sort of said we have a tendency to go from shock to trance. We tend to be shocked when something like high gas prices happens or when something like the Deepwater Horizon spill happens, and then prices go back down, the spill leaves the news, and we go lull back into that trance. So that really does have to change. And certainly, if this past year, basically from the Massey mine disaster to Fukushima, doesn't make you understand those risks, then I'm not sure what will. Absolutely. And, you know, there's something in that story. We talk about shale gas being something part of what we call the era of extreme energy. Basically, you have the ability to get it, say, oil under deep, ultra-deep water, like we saw with Deepwater Horizon. You have the ability to get this kind of natural gas. Perhaps you have nuclear as well. There are other forms of energy out there, but they all carry intensifying risks, basically. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that if you're drilling 3 miles underneath the surface of the ocean to get at oil, it's going to be expensive, it's going to be dangerous, because if anything goes wrong, we saw how difficult it is to deal with a problem like that. Ditto with nuclear power. I would definitely agree that the risks as a whole are fairly low, but at the same time, we can see if something goes wrong, it's very difficult to fix, and of course, the more plants out there in more countries, you're going to have something go wrong. Human error is inevitable in some ways. So that, to me, A, says we should be aware of that fact and understanding that if we're wanting to continue using energy at the rate we're doing, and even increasingly in the future, we're going to have to be accepting these risks, do what we can to minimize them, which is going to require regulation in a much tighter way than we've ever had before. Or we have to say that this is not worthwhile and really begin to focus on other forms of energy that are cleaner, that are more renewable, that have a lower risk, but inevitably are probably going to cost more. So that's a really something society has to deal with. And so paying attention would be step one to that.
And it's so great that Fortune magazine is, again, legitimatizing it. This is clearly not for tree huggers anymore. I can say, sitting here from the Ritz-Carlton at the fourth Fortune Green Business Conference, and it always has struck me, I've been covering this beat for 13 years, as something that absolutely should be relevant to all Americans and certainly business. You know, I always heard, you know, there won't really be a shift until business gets involved, until corporate America gets involved, and, you know, better late than never, but it seems like it is happening. And somehow when the focus is on energy, that makes it not so, you know, granola Birkenstocky. And what is more fundamental to our development, our success, our economy than energy? All it takes is, you know, losing power for a day or two, or look what just happened in Japan, to realize how quickly we recede into the dark ages and how vulnerable we really are. But let's hope that, you know, this does, again, galvanize attention, because we are very good at denial in this country. You know, it is about what the price of the pump, you know, gets everyone up in arms, and then it goes back down below, you know, $4, and people go to sleep again, like you said. But we just cannot afford to do that, because we're kind of late in the game in even addressing these issues. And no solution is going to emerge. It's going to be, you know, risk-free, and it's going to be available overnight in any large quantity. What is your sense of the scalability potential of wind and solar, those being the safest, the cleanest, the ones environmentalists want to promote the most? And I'm continually amazed that it's still just a percentage or two of our total energy, you know, source coming from solar and wind. What is the obstacle there? Is it really all cost? Because it seems increasingly like there are more benign options.
It's interesting you should say that, because I did a panel actually yesterday about whether green energy can scale, and I was talking with a number of CEOs of major renewable companies that are dealing with these problems. You know, first off, we should probably be aware of the fact that it is growing very fast. The reality is the energy system is big. It's like turning around a battleship. It's going to take a long time. So you could see very high levels of growth in wind and solar, which you are, and still it'll take a long time to sort of reach that point where it becomes dominant. So there's that. So we could try to accelerate that through policy, but at the end of the time, it will take a while. Technologically, it's getting better, especially with something like solar, where you're seeing a rapid decrease in cost, both in terms of cells getting better in a technical way, but also manufacturing scaling up, which is important too, which helps cut costs. Wind is more mature, but it can improve as well. But there are other obstacles to really doing this. I mean, these are two forms of energy that require a lot of land. We sort of tend to forget about that fact. I mean, because they are diffuse, if you want a big solar thermal plant in the desert or you want a lot of wind turbines, you have to take up a lot of space. And what a lot of these guys in the field are finding is that what really holds them back is just simple siting processes. I mean, like, if you want to go out and build in the Mojave Desert a big solar thermal plant, you have to do environmental impact assessment statements. You have to do plans on that. You have to make sure there's no Endangered Species Act. All these things have to be dealt with. And, A, they can hold it back sometimes. And you have green groups actually suing to prevent the building of some major renewable utility sources because they're concerned about land use. But also, it just takes a lot of time. It takes years. And when we saw with offshore wind, with Cape Wind off Massachusetts, that took well over a decade.
And some environmentalists thought that.
Quite a few. And, you know, and also there was a NIMBYism to it as well. And the reality is, this is going to be an issue. I mean, people, we're living in a more crowded world, even in the United States, which is still fairly, spread out. And if we really want these forms of energy to take up a lot of the slack, they're going to need a lot of space. And that, you know, we have to speed that process along, but we're not really doing a very good job of that either.
And just in conclusion, what are you taking away from this conference that perhaps you learned or surprised you this time?
I think what I'm taking away is this idea that you're going to see business continuing the work of becoming more efficient, almost regardless of what happens politically. You know, for all the attention we are paying on what happens in D.C., the reality is that these companies don't have to be convinced on that area, and so they'll continue. But the bigger issue, I think, in terms of if we're talking about energy, shifting energy, is that that won't be taken up by business alone. That will need to be a social decision, I think, to prioritize certain forms of energy, to spend the money on research and development, and ultimately to really internalize the costs of those energy forms. I mean, coal is a good example. If we really paid, even putting aside climate, if we really just tried to pay the internal costs or the external costs of health that comes from air pollution from coal, it would be a lot more expensive. So those are the sort of decisions that need to be happening, and to really have a focus in long-term energy policy here in the United States.
And the big exacerbator, of course, climate change, you know, with not to get into politics in the last closing minutes here, but with Tea Partiers, many of them not believing climate change is even a real problem, it's kind of hard to see that, you know, the parties are going to come together, the politicians are going to come together, and yet it's hard to think of a more common enemy to unite together, you know, against than climate change and the attendant energy issues.
Certainly. I mean, that was the case fairly recently. We forget in 2008, this was not a controversial subject. Both presidential candidates agreed on it much more so than on many other things, and that's changed very rapidly for lots of reasons. I mean, because the economy and those problems always cause issues for environmental protection and just as a growing polarization across the board. But right now, you know, right now in D.C., you're going to be seeing votes today, Wednesday, on legislation that would really block the EPA from implementing any greenhouse gas regulations, and then also would look to go even further and strip its power to do a lot of things on pollution. So, you know, how you bridge that gap, I don't know, and this is something we talked about at the conference and didn't really come up with very good solutions, frankly. I hope that people will understand. I think when it becomes a public health issue, that gets people united. People, whether they believe in climate change or not, they don't want asthma for their kids. They don't want smog in the sky. So I think that will be something that will help push cleaner forms of energy and help, you know, give the EPA and other governmental agencies that have that responsibility the power to actually carry out regulations that do help public health.
And the other big concern, of course, jobs. And I don't think it's realistic to think we can, you know, fix the economy, get the unemployment rate down again before we deal with environmental issues. And, of course, green jobs in California, at least, one of the fastest growing job sectors. So we need to incorporate all this together. The time for marginalizing environmental anything, hopefully those days are over. And, again, this conference, I think, goes a long way toward solidifying the, if it needed legitimacy, you know, green being matched with green in this sense, I think, is only a good development. So thank you for your continued great work, Brian Walsh. I highly recommend people pick up next week's issue. It's an environmental report called This Rock Could Power the World. You heard about it here first on the Green Front. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
We'll be back right after these messages. Hopefully we're going to be checking in with Will Sarney. He is an expert on water. He works with a lot of corporations on their water issues. Most recently, he's with Deloitte. So hopefully he'll be joining me in just a moment here on the Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. Stay with us.